It is my great pleasure to introduce Professor Gavin Flood. As I have said before, he would be considered academically a world expert on Hinduism, a world expert at least, but because his book, Introduction to Hinduism, is the standard text in nearly every Western university. Embarrassingly, sorry. But Gavin came to us as academic director 10 years ago now, isn't it? More.
2005.
Yeah, 2005. Nearly 10 years ago.
Almost.
Yeah, almost 10 years ago. I've known Gavin for 30 years.
Is it really?
It is, yeah, yeah.
He had hair then, right?
He had hair, and I was very thin. But he came to us. It was kind of inconceivable that he would come from the heights to such a small venture like us. But from his point of view, it's an adventure, an academic adventure. But Gavin is a very profound scholar. Our students love him, and one of his areas of expertise is Tantra. So over to you.
Thank you, Shulika. Thank you.
And before he makes you disappear.
So, yes, there's an ambiguity about that, isn't there? I'm going to talk about what is tantrism. Now, I hope by the end of the session you have some idea of what it is historically and so on. So I'm going to begin by telling you what it's not. Now, when I was in the States a couple of years ago, I looked in the yellow pages in the phone book, and it said that there was tantric chakra balancing. You could phone up somebody, and for a small fee or for a large fee, probably they would balance your chakras for you, and you could go on various tantric workshops in California and so on. Now, that is tantra is not traditionally, it's not a method of making your love life better, as it were. So that is not what tantrism is.
That's disappointing.
It's disappointing. And it's actually traditionally so. It's not Karma Shastra. It's not like Karma Sutra, Karma Shastra, and so on. It's not that. It's a different discourse entirely. Now, tantrism, the word tantrism, is an external word. It's like Hinduism or Buddhism. It's one of these words, a Western English word, used to denote a whole range of traditions and phenomena that developed in India. Now, what do we mean by it? We mean by tantrism traditions that arose in the late Gupta or early, yeah, the late Gupta or the or after the post-Gupta period. Now, the Guptas end about 600 AD, 600 CE. So, in my view, it's okay to use the word medieval, early medieval traditions for the tantric traditions. I know some of my colleagues disagree with the use of the word medieval. But anyway, it's late Gupta or post-Gupta, so from about the 5th century AD to about the 11th century is really the tantric age, the period when tantric Hinduism and tantric Buddhism develops. Now, there are two Sanskrit terms. There's tantra that we find and tantrika. And we also find phrases tantra shastra, which is the teachings of tantra, and tantra prakriya, the rule or the practice of tantra. So these are the indigenous terms that are used. Now, where is it from? Tantra is from a verbal root, a Sanskrit root, tan, which means to stretch or extend. And I just think about this coming down the road. So the tra is it denotes a sort of instrument in Sanskrit, instrumentality. So I suppose it's an instrument of stretching, literally. So it actually refers to, I think it's the shuttle in a loom. When you have a loom, and you have a shuttle that goes through it, that was called a tantra, I believe. So it has that connotation of a loom and, by extension, a system, so it's a thread on a loom, continuity system, and even theory. Now, the word tantra refers to a text, but not all, or groups of texts, but not all tantric not all tantras are tantric. So you've got groups of texts such as the Panchatantra, which is stories, ancient stories like Aesop's fables or something. Now, the word tantra is there, but it's not tantric at all. And on the other hand, you have great swathes of literature like called Sanhitas, which are Vaishnava tantric texts, which don't contain the word tantra, but which are nevertheless tantric in doctrine and idea. So there's various words, Sanghita, Agama, Sutra, Shastra, Stotra, which we're going to be looking at a little later today, some of these are texts. Now, tantras are believed, these ancient texts are believed to be the revelation of God, and they claim to supersede the Veda. So that's the heart of what a tantra is. It's a text which is believed to be the word of God, which supersedes the Veda. And they're believed to be revelation. And each tantra usually begins with the tantravatara, the descent of the tantra. So they were believed to be a discourse between, say, the goddess and Shiva, and they were overheard by a sage who then communicated it to the human community. So many tantras of vast volumes, 10 volumes of text. And the tantras always say that they are just a pale reflection of the original source, of the original text, which was revealed by Shiva to Parvati. Now, they were composed between the 5th and 11th century, and the oldest is a text called the Nishvasa Tantra, which is probably the earliest elements of which are the 5th century AD, which is very early. And the latest text is probably about the 18th century, the Nirvana Tantra, which some of you may have heard of. Now, who composed them and why did they compose them? And now, these texts, regarded as revelation, but are probably coming from a kind of grassroots level. They're probably a fairly popular movement, which is being articulated in a Sanskrit medium and claiming revelation, claiming authority. But then gets very quickly appropriated by the Brahmanical tradition. So the Vedic Brahmanical tradition, the Vaidika tradition, appropriates the Tantrika tradition very, very quickly and very readily. I'll be talking more about that presently. Now, where do they come from? There's some debate about this. They're certainly in Kashmir, certainly in Nepal, and possibly the origins of Tantra are in Karnataka. Because there have been very early Kaula texts found in Karnataka, very early texts found in Karnataka, and that could be the origin of the Tantric tradition, which spread north from Karnataka. Well, we don't know. And that's speculation from manuscript sources and so on. And why? Why were they composed? These texts were composed, they claimed to be revelation, they were responding to something, they were reacting against the Vedic tradition, against the traditions of the power of the Brahmins, who said, we have the authority, we can interpret the scriptures. There was a mass movement against that, as it were, and the tantras give voice to the rise of lower caste groups, really. But the rise of those lower caste groups, it gets very quickly appropriated into the Brahmanical discourse. Now, one of the beauties, in a sense, of the Brahmanical tradition is that it is adaptability, it's adaptation to local conditions, and the way it absorbs everything. And I think it was Stahl, maybe, who coined the phrase Sanskritization. I can't remember who coined that phrase, but he talks about Sanskritization, the absorption of local traditions into the mainstream tradition. And we have this with gods like Krishna. Krishna was probably a local deity, who gets absorbed into the tantric tradition. Into the Brahmanical tradition. He also gets absorbed into the tantric tradition, but that's another story. Now, these tantras, who were composed by lower caste groups but get appropriated by the Brahmins, became very attractive to medieval kings. And really, medieval Hinduism from about the 6th, 7th century right the way through to the 13th century is really, we could call it tantric Hinduism. It's dominated by these texts called tantras, and the priests who knew about the text and who served the kings, the Purohits, the Brahman, the priests who attended the king. So a text I'm working on at the moment called the Natra Tantra, the Tantra of the Eye, was composed in a royal court for the royalty, and it's mainly composed for the protection of the king, because the recitation of the text protected the king and his family from external enemies, but also from spiritual enemies, the Bhutas and the demons and so on, which were constantly threatening to invade the kingdom and the king. So these texts were, we have to understand them as not just obscure texts being composed on the margins of society, but as central to the polity of the polities of the kings of India in the medieval period. Now, some of these tantras accept the Veda and some reject the Veda, but all claim to supersede the Veda. There was a lot of debate about this in the medieval period. There was one philosopher called Jayanta Bhatta, who, in Kashmir, who wrote, he was a Nyayaka, a follower of the Nyaya. He wrote a wonderful book called Nyayamanjari, The Offering of the Flowers of Logic. And in this book, he defends the tantras as revelation. He says, why shouldn't God appear to us now in this modern world, in this modern age? Why should God have just showed himself back in ancient Vedic times? Why shouldn't he show himself now? He's speaking in the 11th century. And so he defends the authenticity of the tantric revelation. But he's also critical of the tantric revelation. And he wrote a wonderful play called the Agamadambara, Much Ado About Scripture, really, and in which he's lampooning these tantric ascetics called Karpalikas. And it's a very funny play about this. And he actually Jayanta Bhatta gets put in prison. It's a bit like Boethius. He may have died in prison. But in prison, he wrote this great thick book called the Nyayamanjari, the Bouquet of the Flowers of Logic. And he was in prison because he was critical of the king of Kashmir for absorbing and taking on tantric practices and for encouraging a cult called the Nilambras, the blue-clad cult, who, according to Jayanta, says they advocated caste-free sex in public places. No, it's probably unlikely, but anyway, that was his imagination. He thought that the king of Kashmir was adopting or was supporting these fringe groups, and much to Jayanta's disapproval. So anyway, he got put in prison for this. But so he's defending the tantric revelation, but within certain boundaries. And Yamuna, Ramanuja's teacher, also defends the tantric revelation, but only the tantric revelation of Vishnu and not of Shiva and the other deities. Now, these tantras were composed in a number of traditions. The Vishnu religion, Vaishnavism, had the Pancharatra, a group called the Pancharatra. So when Ramanuja is doing his liturgy in the Srirangam temple, he's doing it according to tantric rituals, according to the Pancharatra rituals. Now, it's interesting that he never wrote a commentary on Pancharatra texts. The intellectual energy of the Vaishnava tradition seemed to have gone into the Vedanta, not into the tantric tradition. So the tantric tradition seemed to provide Vishnuism, Vaishnavism with ritual, but not with much intellectual substance, as it were. So you get the Vaishnava tantras, Shaiva tantras, and Shakta tantras, and also tantras to the Sansaura tantras, Garuda tantras, which is concerned with snake bites, Buddhist tantras and Jaina tantras. All these different religions have their own tantric texts, but they all share certain properties in common. They all claim to come from a higher source, come down into the world, descend into the world, and they all claim to have liberation and power as their purpose. Now, to understand these texts, we have to have a look at patterns of history, and you've got this pattern of Brahmanical appropriation of these local traditions. So you have to imagine a situation in which there are low caste groups living on the edges of society coming up with these texts. Now, how are they doing it? Why are they doing it? There's lots of speculation about this. Some people say that they're having visions in their meditation. Some people are saying that they are becoming possessed by goddesses and so on, and then taking control of those goddesses in order to gain power. And that's certainly, in some tantric texts, that seems to be the case. Arvesha Mam, enter me, they would say. But then you get control of the goddess. And so we have a spectrum of traditions with degrees of conformity to the Veda. So if you imagine medieval India, you've got the mainstream Vedic tradition of Brahmins worshipping orthodox deities in orthodox ways, and these were, let's take Shiva for example. Shiva, the worship of Shiva, the orthodox worshippers of Shiva following the Vedas were called Maheshwaras, and they believed that the universe was like an egg, was an anda, and this world was here. And when you die, if you're devoted, if you're a bhakta, if you're a Shiva bhakta, you get reborn in the Shiva loka, which is the top of the world egg. And there'll be no more return for you into this world. Now a tradition comes along called the Atimarga, the path which goes beyond the Vedas, and says, we've got something better than that. This is still within the world egg. We have a method of yoga which cracks the world egg and the soul can escape from the top of the world egg. It's like, you know, in the morning, cracking your egg, slicing it off. So that's what the Atimarga came to do. So the soul could actually get out of this whole system, this whole universe, to this other place, to this liberation, this state of moksha, or liberation way beyond the universe. And then the Mantramarga claimed to transcend the Atimarga. So you've got stages of transcendence of the previous tradition, right, the way along. And this also indicates stages of conformity to Vedic values. So on the sheet that I've handed out on page 2, there's on the left-hand side you've got a plus sign with orthodox or orthoprax, and a minus sign with orthodox or orthoprax on the right-hand side. So this model is more or less based on a scholar called Alexis Sanderson's work, who has kind of changed our understanding of the tantric traditions. He's in the bibliography at the back.
Can I just ask, was this part of a general democratization of Brahmanical, of religion in India? Because that was the time when idolatry took root in the country. Prior to that, it was a fairly exclusive, the only path was through the Brahmin.
Yes.
The texts were not written, it wasn't available to the masses. So was Tantra a part of that sort of general democratization process?
The religion becomes much more open to other people. So to low caste people, to women, could gain liberation through this method. Whereas before, it was exclusively male, exclusively Brahmanical. So it is. As Bhakti represented the popularization.
I believe idolatry was also something that emerged during that period from the idea of giving access to people to the masses.
Yes.
Because they can then put an idol of worship to it, offer flowers and essence.
That's right.
Which wasn't there before.
That's right. So that's right. Or you create an image which is a reflection of the main image in the temple, but you're not allowed if you're a certain kind of.
Proliferous were temples at that time, and were there a lot of
there were temples at this period, yes. No. Yes, at the 10th 11th century. As to the Chola kings,
10th 11th was later in the say 5th
6th. Oh yeah, I don't think there were temples
around
then.
Any.
No. Well, Julius might know.
This is the subject of my present research. Okay. Precisely this point. Archaeological data has discovered in Middle India temples to Shiva and Vishnu, 3rd, 4th century BC.
Oh, really? BC. Wow.
Middle India, Madhya Pradesh, that area.
3rd, 4th
century BCE.
BCE. To Shiva
and Vishnu. There's strong archaeological data for that.
Which is the earliest living?
If you look at the Nispashak Tantra mentioned by Professor Flood, you will see already, and that is the earliest sections of 5th, 6th century, you will see references to Shivalaya. That is Shiva, abode of Shiva temples, have been translated by Gudor on one of Shiva temples. So the temples were a flourishing concern already by the beginning of the Common Era. Mm-hmm. And in fact, even 3-4, I have located in my work that I'm doing at present, the likelihood of temples being in existence already in 4th, 5th, 6th century BC.
Which is the oldest temple in India today? The oldest.
Surviving.
That we can see? Which one is it?
That I can't tell.
And it's
Mahabalipuram, possibly?
Patutukal is, I think, is the first temple that is still in existence. It's not a practicing. It's not a practicing temple.
If you look at Panini's
in northern Karnataka,
you look at Panini's Ashtadhyayi. Panini's Ashtadhyayi, he already there refers to images of gods, Skanda and so forth, for sale.
I see.
So,
because when Al-Biruni came in,
that is 1000.
No, 11th century. Yeah. He was recording what he perceived in the. So he narrates the story of democratization that was taking place through access, but his narration suggests that it was relatively recent. Although, you know.
It depends where you are.
Exactly, of course.
But anyway, this is just to answer your question.
Yeah, yes, very interesting. I didn't know that they were so old. That's very interesting. They go back to the 4th, 5th century BC. Very, very good. Well, it doesn't surprise me, actually, because they would have... Where do people worship and so on, if not in a temple of some kind? But perhaps they were made of wood. I'm not sure if they could have been of stone, because they would have survived.
These ones that have been... I forget the exact place, but they are in central India somewhere, west of central India. These are stone structures made of rammed mud.
Right.
So they are not wood. There may have been earlier versions of wood, but these are actually stone structures.
Very interesting, yes. There could be a continuity of architecture going back thousands of years, possibly. Who knows? I saw, just an aside, I was reading a book on Neanderthals the other day, and they found an image of a man with a lion's head, and I thought that was very interesting. Way back at, you know. No, I thought, Neanderthals are way back there. So. Anyway, so the tantric tradition, then you've got this process of appropriation, and if there were temples, they were probably being possibly even taken over by tantric traditions in some sense. So the Pashupatas, who were an ascetic group of the Atimurga, became extremely powerful. So the Somnath, that Indian historian whose name I forget, has written a book on this, it's very interesting, which was sacked by Mahmud of Ghazni in 1023, and there was a gold linga there, Shiva linga, that he took away and presumably melted down, I suppose. So the Pashupatas, they owned a lot of land, and they were very wealthy, and they were tantric ascetics, really, pre-tantric ascetics. They didn't reveal the tantras, because the texts weren't really around at that time of the Pashupatas, but they were certainly proto-tantric ascetics. And, of course, like all monastic institutions, once they get a certain degree of wealth, the kings and so on go for them, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what happened to the Pashupatas as well. By the late medieval period, the Pashupatas were really no more. Now, the Mantra Marga, the path of mantras, which is tantric Hinduism. And there's two main groups here. There's one called the Shaiva Siddhanta, which you've probably all heard of, which is still flourishing in South India, and the other, which we can call non-Siddhanta groups, which used to be called Kashmir Shaivism, but we know it was much bigger than Kashmir. It extended far beyond the borders of Kashmir. And the Shaiva Siddhanta worshipped Shiva in a linga form, but also as a god called Sadashiva, five-faced, five-headed Sadashiva. And they still do. And that's the normative, this becomes normative tantric ritual. The system of the Shaiva Siddhanta is like Buddhism, like Mahayana Buddhism is the normative, becomes normative Buddhism, and the tantric Buddhism is overlaid on top of that. So tantric Shaivism is overlaid on the normative system of the Shaiva Siddhanta. Now, the Shaiva Siddhanta revered the Vedas. They thought, the Vedas are great, but we've got this other revelation that goes beyond the Vedas. And what do we do if we perform certain actions, that gets us liberated from this life at the end of when we die. And then we go to be with Shiva, we get liberated. Now, it's a dualistic system because it maintains that the soul is eternally distinct from God, the Shaiva Siddhanta. They're not fused together. So the three realities, world, soul, and God, eternally distinct. And that through a process of ritual, you can clean the soul so that it rises up through the universe to the top of the universe, to Shiva's Shiva's world. Now the non-Siddhanta groups, that became normative Shaivism throughout India. And there's a particular, from the middle of India, there's a text called the Somashambhupadati, the ritual manual of 11th century theologian called Somashambhu, which becomes the standard text of a ritual pattern in India. And it's still followed in South Indian temples today. And in Kerala, Tantric Shaivism in Kerala is normative Hinduism. So if, I don't know if anyone's from Kerala, but if you go to a temple, you'll get... the Tantris are just ordinary temple priests who perform the pujas and so on.
I'm sorry, I'm very confused. Could you explain the difference between Shaiva Siddhanta and non-Siddhanta?
Yeah, the Shaiva Siddhanta is dualistic. It says there are three realities in the universe, and it says that you achieve liberation through ritual, through action, through cleaning the soul, through your actions. Ritual action cleans the soul. So it's covered in a substance called mala, or impurity. You have to scrub that clean. And then once the soul is clean, it can be liberated at death. When you die, you go to be with Shiva. You attain equality with Shiva, something called Shiva Tulya, equality with Shiva. So you don't become Shiva, you become a Shiva, as it were.
And that is practiced in the South?
It's practiced in the South. Usually practiced in the North, but not anymore. It's Shaiva Siddhanta. Yeah.
And in the Shiva Shambhu Padatis, are they rituals for prayer, or they're rituals for personal cleansing?
They're both. They're rituals for personal cleansing every day in the daily rites, and also for temple rituals as well. And
it's still practiced.
Still practiced.
But are these practiced in all Shiva temples in the south, or are they just the tantric Shiva temples?
Just in Shaiva Siddhanta temples, like in Pondicherry and so on. That's right.
And the choice of Shiva, was that considered to be partially a reaction to the more Vaishnavi?
Yes, I think it probably was. There was a dominance of Vishnu religion, and then the Shiva comes up and gets adopted by the kings, like the Chola kings and so on.
When you hear about the Tamil Siddhas, are they the same as the Shaiva Siddhanta, or is that a different tradition?
Yeah, the Tamil Siddhas, they are not the Shaiva Siddhanta. They are the non-Siddhantic groups. The Tamil Siddhas come up on that side of things. And they become associated with the Lingayat tradition as well.
So what
Tamil
is
Siddhas.
A non-Siddhanta?
Yeah, I just come to that
question. What are the three things for the Shaiva reality?
Is it the three realities? Is it the soul, world, and God?
Yes, that's right.
Soul, world, and God.
Yeah, soul, world, and God. Pashu, they call it Pashu, Pati, and Pasha.
Oh, Pashu, Pati.
Yes, that's right. Now, the non-Siddhanta groups, they tend to be monistic, say that world, God, and soul are one thing. There's not a difference between them. So the world is an emanation or manifestation of God. And me, my soul, and my person is an emanation of God. So what is a tantra? One of the characteristics of a tantra is it's a divinization, ritual divinization of the person. So to worship a god, you have to become a god. It's a very famous tantric saying that to become a god, you have to worship. To worship a god, you have to become the god first. So there's a process, which I'll tell you about in a minute, of the way the body is divinized and so on. So these non-Siddhanta groups then tend to be monistic. They worship a different form of Shiva, Bhairava, a ferocious form of the god, who's got these bulging eyes and is a very ferocious deity. And they tend to be antinomian, which means that they go against Vedic norms. Why do they do that? They say that the people who follow the Vedas are inhibited and restricted, and they don't experience life properly, and they can't possibly achieve liberation because they're too uptight and they're too paranoid about what's going on in the world. So these Brahmins, they say, they're obsessed with their ritual purity, and they don't go out into the sun in case a demon comes in through the shadow, through the chidra. So that's no way to live, these ascetics thought. So they're reacting against that. And they say that, okay, well, how do we react against that in an extreme way? In order to gain liberation, we have to go against Vedic injunctions, against purity rules. We have to court impurity. So therefore, we have sex outside of caste restrictions. We drink alcohol and make and offer alcohol to the gods. And we offer meat and blood to these ferocious deities. Now, these groups on the very edges of Brahman, on the very edges of society, really, were doing these kinds of practices. Now, the Kapalikas were those who ascetics who carried a skull-topped staff, a katvanga, a staff with a skull on it, and they carried a skull begging bowl. And they were ferocious kind of characters, and if an Orthodox Brahmin saw one, he had to briefly stare into the sun to purify his eyes. These were unseeables. You heard of the untouchables, these were unseeables, these characters. But they said that liberation could be achieved through going against Shankar. Shankar means inhibition. This was characterized by the Vedic Brahmin. You have to get rid of inhibition in order to achieve liberation, which is living life to the full, as it what they perceived to be the fullness of life, as exemplified by Bhairava, whose bulging eyes and face exemplify his entrance into the fullness of sensual experience. Now, these Kapalika ascetics, who are lampooned in literature, but even in Kalidasa, I think, as some of you may know, they become like a monstrous character. But they were fairly important ascetics, and out of this Kapalika religion, so which is ascetic, but on the other hand, it's worshipping ferocious deities with impure substances, you get what's called Kashmir Shaiv, what came to be called Kashmir Shaivism, or the Trika. The Trika means threefold, because it worshipped three goddesses. Now, Abhinavagupta, who you may have heard of, was a very important tantric philosopher in Kashmir, who dies about 1050. Now, he takes these low-caste practices and transforms them into a Brahmanical form which is acceptable to the Brahmins. He transforms them into aesthetic kind of categories, an aesthetic experience. So it's not that you... one of the things that these Kapalika traditions, these Kapalika ascetics did was you have to offer impure substances to these goddesses and gods to appease them, to keep them quiet. Now, Abhinavagupta says, that's not what's going on really. What it is, it's the aesthetic experience of union of Shiva and Shakti, which reflects the union of Shiva and Shakti as an ontological state. So he aestheticizes these low-caste Kapalika practices. And then you've got a tradition called the Kala tradition, which is a goddess-worshipping tradition, which is, again, a very popular movement focused on Shakti and the goddess. Now, the Kapalika, the Kala and Kapalika traditions were very often concerned with this worldly concern, with magic. They wanted to keep the goddesses, these demons, out of your life, and they wanted you to be successful. People, you want to be king of the Deccan, then if you do these rituals, you can be king of the Deccan. And the Nitya Kala, which is the oldest Kala text that we know, which is only in manuscript form, which we were reading not too long ago here, was it's full of magic. It's full of... I think it's just a bunch of sad blokes who can't get girlfriends, really, because you imagine this woman and you imagine hooks coming out of your heart and hooking onto her and pulling her into you, and that way you can get a girlfriend. So lots of kind of low-caste magic, if you like, amongst these sects, like the Nitya Kaula. But when it gets appropriated by Brahmanism, all that gets stripped away, and it becomes this kind of high-class, high-level philosophy of union with the Absolute, union with Shiva, and developing practices of meditation to achieve that. So moving on quickly, the main ideas of Tantra, then, that's the sort of historical overview. The main idea is that the aim of these traditions is liberation, moksha, and power, siddhi, power in this world, magical power, power against over your enemies, and power to attract people to your cause or to your person. There's an emphasis on the goddess as power, Shakti, such as Kali and Kundalini. Kundalini is the goddess who is within the body, who is located in at the base of the spine or at the base of the central channel, who through yoga can be awakened and rises up the central channel. And that goes right into yoga. So modern yoga is very strongly influenced by the tantric traditions and Kundalini and so on. Another main idea is there's a polarity between Shiva and Shakti. The universe comprises male and female dimensions, which are Shiva and Shakti, which need to be united in this state of liberation. And that's symbolically depicted as the body, Shiva, is at the crown of the head, and Shakti is at the base of the central channel, and she rises up to unite with Shiva at the crown of the head, at or above the crown of the head. Or what's called the Dvadashanta, the point 12 fingers above the crown. So if you measure 12 fingers from the centre of your eyes there, which is there, that's where Shiva is. Or there's another Dvadashanta, which is 12 fingers above there. So Shiva lives there or there, depending on the tradition, and you have to unite Shakti with Shiva at the crown of your head through yogic practices. Another feature is that there's a hierarchical cosmos. There's the universe is a hierarchy of levels, with the pure realms at the top and the impure worlds at the bottom, and the hells beneath that. And the aim is for your soul to rise up through the cosmos to the pure realms. And you recapitulate this each day in your ritual. And these categories are called tattvas, levels of reality. And all the tantric texts are full of this stuff. They call them bhuvanas, different worlds, different bhuvanas. And you can actually historically locate, if you've got, say, 224 million worlds, it says in one of the Shaivasiddhanta texts. Like the world of the Pashupatas, the Atimarga, was called Dhruva. I can't spell Dhruva. Is it called an H? Yeah, Dhruva.
Dhruva.
Which is the pole star, of course. Now that was one of the world, the highest world of the Pashupatas. They believed that was the world of Shiva, and that through your yoga, you could go to that world. Now the later traditions come along and say, we go beyond the world of Dhruva, we have a Shiva Loka, or we have a different higher world. And so that process carries right the way through. So there are 36 levels, tattvas, in the Shaiva Siddhanta system. Abhinavagupta said, I teach the 37th tattva, which isn't a level, the level which isn't a level. Because if God is everywhere, how can God be a level of the universe? God must pervade all the levels and be beyond all levels. So this is a very common pattern. Another feature is the divinization of the person in ritual meditation. And the cosmos is within you, and you are within the cosmos. And so there's the tantric traditions are terribly ritualistic. So the main thing is ritual. Daily ritual, which comprises various stages. First of all, the bath in ashes and also in water, and then followed by the Bhuta Shuddhi, the purification of the elements in the body, which is the ritual. You map the universe onto your body, so the world of Shiva is at your head and the earth is at your feet, and you imagine a fire burning from the toe of the left foot, the Kalagni, the fire of time, which burns your body to a pile of ashes in your imagination, and then you recite mantras, Om Jom Sah or whatever, and that washes away the ashes, so that you're in your imagination, your body has been destroyed. But whose body? Your soul's body. And then you recreate the body through a process called Nyasa. You touch the body and repeat mantras. And then once you've done that, the body is divine. And you then can worship God in your imagination. So the pattern is the same. You imagine God at the Dvadashanta above the crown of your head. You create a throne in your heart, in your imagination, and you bring God through the crown of your head and sit him on a throne in your heart. And there you do puja with in your imagination to the deity.
Manasik puja.
Yes, manasa puja, yes. Mental worship. the inner worship. And then, having done that, you then worship God outside in an external icon.
But these nyasas are practiced even not only in Tantra, they are practiced in the daily puja as well.
That's right, that's right. I think this is evidence for the pervasion of the tantric traditions out beyond the tantric sphere into all areas of Hinduism.
Yeah, in Vaishnava.
Yeah, Vaishnava.
Yes, yes, in Vaishnavism you do the nyasa and so on, yes. And this is evidence of the all-pervasive nature of the tantric tradition, and its importance.
The idea of the body as just the mantra Om Namah Shivaya as the panchabhuta, the five elements.
Yes.
Does that originate from one of these?
Well, I think that comes from Samkhya as well, that the five elements and so on. So I think that's very ancient. But I'm not sure of the origins of the way it's mapped onto the body. It's certainly there in the tantric traditions. It's certainly there's a text, one of the oldest sources for this is a Vaishnava text called the Jayakya Sanghita, which is the locus classicus of the mapping of the cosmos onto the body. So it's got different chapters on each of these four stages. But that's probably not. I mean, there are elements of that text which may be 8th century. There may be texts much earlier than this that I can't remember at the moment. But yes, the five elements are terribly important in all of this. Now I want to have a look at a text in a minute. Yeah, let's look at the text now. Now, if you turn to this handout, at the back of this handout, you've got a tantric text, just a short tantric text. It's a stotra or a hymn. It's called the Dehasta Devata Chakra Stotra, the hymn to the circle of gods, of deities in the body, in the Deha, located in the body. Now you've got the... this is the from Kashmir visualization text. There's the actual... this part of the text is the visualization, and this is the hymn in the different scripts. So that's the hymn there. So you recite the hymn while doing this puja to the circle of gods in your body. Now these are the yoginis, the eight yoginis, goddesses who are located in the heart. Now at the centre of the circle there, if you've got this in your handouts, you've got Shakti. It says Shakt Guru. And you'll probably be able to read it, many of you. Chaitanya, you see that? You've got. Guru at the top. I can't quite make out the next word. Chaitanya. Shakti.
Guru Shiv.
Guru Shiv, yeah. That's right. Guru Shiva. Yeah. So they're in your heart. This lotus is in your heart. And then you imagine that lotus in your heart, and all the petals all the way around. So the top petal is Purava, is the east, which is in front of you. So the east is always in front of you, as you probably know. The west is behind you. The east is the rising sun. The west is behind you. Dakshina is to the right, the south. Vama to the left, the north.
Is this a mandala? Hmm? Is it like a mandala for meditation?
Yeah, that's right. It's a mandala for meditation. That's right. Yeah. That's right. That's what it is. And then you've got the goddesses located all the petals round about. So.
Excuse me, I think
Professor,
you're going to
slow
down.
We've lost you. Sorry. Yeah, okay. You've got...
The one on top is east.
Goodbye, everybody.
Bye-bye, Julius.
It's been a pleasure meeting all of you.
Lovely to see you again.
Thank you. I learned a lot from you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, sorry, I'm rushing ahead. This picture is a manuscript from Kashmir. It's probably about 10th century or something. And it's this lotus here. You'd imagine this in your heart, in your daily ritual. So right in the centre of the calyx of the lotus, you've got these names. You've got Guru. The Guru is there. Shiva is there. Chaitanya, which means consciousness, that is there. And then on all of these other petals round about, you've got these different goddesses.
Yeah, Brahmi, Maheshwari, Komala.
Yes, that's right. They're all located on the lotus. So the at the top there is the east. At the bottom is the west. Because that's the direction you face it. You face the east. The sun comes up in the east.
Top is the east.
Yeah, top is the east. The sun rises in the east.
What is this?
It's a meditation. It's a meditation.
Is that connected to all the chakras and the petals and all of that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it is, but the slightly different way. This is just in the heart, so right. The rest of the body is ignored.
Okay.
Yeah. For this.
But this is only for the tantric meditation.
Yes, this is the tantric meditation.
All of the chakra and the Kundalini meditations came out of this tantric tradition.
That's right.
I was trying to connect the dots from things we're familiar with.
That's right.
To this
it's spread out from there, connected with all these other traditions.
But,
that's right.
But then, is there a different version of this petal picture where the samsara, which is from the
yes,
petals,
that's right.
That's
so you've got these two models. You've got a hierarchical model where the God is at the top, if you like, that where this petal is there, and another model which is in the heart. So you've got these two kind of competing models, if you like, of what's going on in the body. It's very interesting. Okay, so you'd have this visualization, you'd visualize that, and then you'd recite this hymn. Now this hymn, if you go to the two pages on, with the heavy script, let's test your Devanagari here. You see this one, the heavy script, two pages after the...
It's the same manuscript.
Same manuscript,
what's
yes.
What's the name of the manuscript?
It's just in a bundle called the Dehasta Devatar Chakra Stotra. That's what it is. Yeah. It's in the bibliography.
Likai.
Likai.
They
hardly
the
Devatar.
Yeah. That comes from a text called the Kubjikar Mata Tantra in the 11th century. That's where it first occurs.
Here it is. It's in English. It's here in English.
No, it's here in English.
Yeah, you've got it in the bibliography. The details of this manuscript are in the references.
Because he's so smart.
So, I'll go to the minute. So, everyone got that page?
He's there.
Right, let's start reading. See the first letter? It's Om. Om Shri Ganeshaya Namaha. Can you see that, everyone?
Yeah.
Om Shri Ganeshaya Namaha.
Om Shri
Ganeshaya
Namaha.
Yeah. Sura Sura Vrinda. Anyway, I've done a transliteration.
Yeah, it's impossible.
I've cheated.
Because all the sandhis have to go.
Yes. So on page 4. On page 4, everybody, you've got the actual text. Om Shri Ganeshaya Namaha, Om Shri Asura Asura Vinda Vanditam.
But is it this hymn? Is it only to the to the female?
Yes, that's right.
Goddesses.
So to the goddesses, yes, that's right.
It doesn't involve only in the beginning. It talks of Ganesh.
That's right.
The
rest of it is all the goddesses. That's right. So
Shakti,
that's right. So this is a karma text, so I just want to bring your attention to a couple of things. And you can see on homage to Ganesh, Om Holi, I praise Ganapati, Vande, I praise, Ganapati, reading backwards, I praise Ganapati, Prana Tanu, whose body, whose Tanu, is prana, is breath, or particularly the exhale breath. And who is the Pujam, who is to be worshipped as the Arugriya, as the pinnacle of the Darshanashata, as the 100 systems, who's worshipped as the pinnacle of the 100 systems of philosophy, and who delights in the bestowal of desired wishes, the Abhimatavara, those varas, those boons which are desired. And then I praise Vatuka, the next verse 2, I praise Vatuka, who's Skanda, of course, known as the inhaled breath, the prana, the apana, the downward breath, who removes people's pain. His feet are worshipped by the lineage of perfected ones, the siddhas, and the hordes of yoginis. These yoginis are the female deities who are dangerous but also give you power, and the best of heroes, the viras. the spelling mistake that I've noticed in my transliteration here should be Vira. And so I won't read the whole thing, but let me draw your attention to verse 3. I always praise the pure, true master, the Satguru, whose nature is attentiveness, and by the power of his thought, he reveals the universe as a path of Shiva for his devotees. That's very interesting, because the whole universe is a path towards Shiva, back to Shiva, for those who worship, for those who are devoted, for those bhaktas. And then it goes on, number 4, I praise Ananda Bhairava, that's a form of Shiva, who is made of consciousness, Chaitanya, and whom the goddesses of the senses constantly worship in the lotus of the heart with the pleasures of their own sense objects, their own vishayas. So all these goddesses are goddesses of the senses. So the goddess of sight has the realm of sight as her object, and she offers that to Shiva. The goddess of touch has the realm of touch as her object, and she offers that to Shiva, and so on. So it goes...
Is Shiva here used as a figure Shiva, or is it used as... an alternative term for broad consciousness?
It's used for both. It's used for Chaitanya, broad consciousness, and it's actually an iconography of Ananda Bhairava. He's a figure.
But the overall one. Ananda Bhairava comes up in a couple of places, but overall, wherever Shiva is used in this text, is it intended to be that Shiva was. It's pure consciousness. Because in a lot of cases they speak about the term for consciousness is also just Shiva as consciousness.
Yes, that's right. And you've got both. You've got both the impersonal consciousness and the personified Shiva. And that's very interesting in the Indian traditions. You get that. Anyway, go through the list and then down to the bottom, verse 14. I praise constantly the Lord of the body who gives perfection known as the self. United with the 36 categories of the Tattvas, he is worshipped as the Lord of the 6 systems of philosophy. And 15, in this manner, I praise the circle of deities innate within the body, an elevated assembly continually present, the end of everything, vibrant, the essence of experience, the Anubhavasara, the essence of experience. And thus the sacred hymn to the circle of deities in the body is fully completed. So it's an interesting hymn, and it encapsulates the tantric view of the world, really, in that one hymn, I always think. Now, moving on, I'm sort of shut up soon, so I'll talk to a couple of more minutes. Okay.
I just want to take you all the way back. I'm not clear about what the essence of Tantra is relative to the Vedic traditions. I mean, we're into a lot of the detail of what the texts are and so on. But if you stepped all the way back, all the way before you even get into the Vedic tradition, the Yati Marga, the Varga.
Yes.
So do they believe that, you know, that the details are different, back to the pluralistic discussion we had 2 days ago, right? The details are different about what that cosmic consciousness is, whether it's called Shivaloka or Ati-Shivaloka or whatever. But basically, is Tantra also believing in the same things? Can you just contrast?
Yeah, I think that you can get beyond the details and you can summarize it by saying that Tantrism believes that the universe is energy, is spanda, is vibration of Shakti, of energy, and that we, in some sense, have an intimate relationship with that. With that energy or that power.
And through puja, we awaken that energy.
Yes, right. Through puja, we awaken that energy.
Through puja, practices
are quite important.
Yeah, practice.
That's right. Sorry, I should have mentioned that earlier. Yeah, the key thing in Tantra is practice, sadhana, not philosophy.
And then there's a dark side to Tantra.
Yes.
Why is that? What is the dark side?
Well, exactly. What is that? That question is a very important question. Why is there this dark side to Tantra?
Right.
And one response by actually a professor here, Zainer, many years ago now, said that it was because it's monistic. The dark side, once you've got monism, one thing, you've got no ethics. Monism is the doctrine that there's one reality in the universe. That there's I am identical with the absolute. That's non-dualism. And he says that Tantrism is non-dualism, and Tantrism is a logical outcome of that, which means it's immoral. Because if you've got monism, you can't have morality, says Zainer. So how can
you are God.
Why?
Because you're God. So you can kill 1,000 Brahmins, who cares?
But that's what Advaita, how does it contrast to Advaita Vedanta?
Yeah.
Well, Advaita Vedanta also says that your soul is part of
it. Yeah, that's a good point here. Advaita Vedanta also says that. But, so Abhinavagupta takes on this. He says, actually, we're not these Shankara-type non-dualists. They, for them, God is a eunuch. God has no power. But for the tantric tradition, we have shakti, we have energy and power. We recognize energy as the heart of the universe. And we also, we're realists, Abhinavagupta says. We believe in the reality of the senses and sense experience, but it is identical with Shiva. That's a different position to the Shankara position. Tying up some of the dark side of Tantra then, according to Zeno, it's got no morality. So that's the dark side of Tantra. The other dark side of Tantra is, which can be dark, is that in order to come to terms with life, you have to come to terms with the horrific aspects of existence, like death and suffering. That's what, and Tantra tries to face that, tries to look at that in the face, and look at death in the eye and say, ah, yes, I can still look at you in the eye and maintain my integrity and maintain liberation with some higher force or some higher power.
And was there a different objective to Tantra as well, where they were trying to seek control and power?
Yes, absolutely.
As opposed to, where the goal was itself control and power as opposed to realization and moksha.
Yes, that's right. No, this was formalized into two kinds of initiation. One was called the Acharya Abhisheka, the sprinkling for to become a teacher, and the other one was called the Sadaka Abhisheka, where you seek power. You say, yeah, I want liberation, but not yet. It's like Augustine says, oh yeah, give me purity, but not yet, in his prayer. So you want liberation, but you want to have fun on the way as well. So you want pleasure in higher worlds as a Sadaka.
And where do the skulls and all come about? I mean, skulls and pus and ashes and
that's right.
No.
I think this is
the impure things about God of
this is impurity.
I think the impurity is the theories is that you have to confront all these hugely negative things. It's the antithesis of life, and you have to understand the antithesis in order to experience the life.
Yes, that's right.
So that is why
transform it by going into all the people can put
tantric spells and all, is that correct?
That's a low caste Kaula tantric magic. Yes,
so what is that?
Black magic.
That's black magic that the
but doesn't the Veda speak of black magic as well? Yes. So how is it different from what the Tantra says?
Well, it's actually the same as far as I can see. It's just
different
types,
just a later.
Yes, that's right. I agree that's how Tantrism, there's not that much new in it, apart from these new texts that say, ah, oh, we're new.
They
codify it. Is Kali the tantric goddess?
Yes, she is. She's a tantric goddess. She's originally called Kala Sankarshini, the one who destroys time. Sankarshini is a puller or a tractor.
So that's why they say Kali Kapali, so they try her back to the
yes, Kapali. Yes, that's right. She's a ferocious goddess.
Can I just take you back to this whole thing of if monotheistic is no morality? Because
this,
is no morality. Because the whole thing about you being one with pure consciousness is that the journey to from where you are, which you are human and thing, to pure consciousness is all about morality. But we're dismissing it very quickly by saying, oh, it's no morality.
Oh, yeah, I'm not condoning Zaina's view, but that was his view.
Oh,
that was
the whole point of this whole thing is when you become one, you have reached a certain end of the journey, but the whole journey is what it's all about.
No, but the
means
of the
journey. Of course,
there are texts which say,
if
I'm Shiva, I can do anything.
The starting point is different. Yes. In Tantra, the starting point is says, I'm already God. There is no journey to be made. So whatever I do is moral. It doesn't matter. I can.
That's right. If there's only one reality in the universe.
Whereas in Advaita, I'm journeying to the divine, so I have a whole process with God.
Also, your soul is the same as the thing you are. God. Each person is that's the potential.
That's the potential.
That's not where you are in the means of getting there.
So, I'll wind up talking in a minute, but before I stop, there's just a couple of things. Yeah, are we going to have this question? But go on in.
So, where does the tantric sense come in? Is it on the
dark side, or is it? It's a question a lot of our minds actually. Or is it? It is an experience to experience. To be at one with the divine.
Originally, it's on the dark side, and it gets appropriated into
the mainstream.
When
the Brahmins have decided Brahmins. This is a good thing.
That's right, when the Brahmins have decided this is okay.
No, the tantric
quarter. It starts off in this dark side, so you have these Kapalikas, there's sex with low-caste women in order to produce, rather unpleasant actually, rather to produce substances to make offerings to these ferocious deities. Now that Gabriel Navagotra comes up, well, that's all very well, but that's we don't want anything to do with that. We want, this is actually, it's about an aesthetic experience. This is a whole ritual where this is making love. It goes from sex to making love in order to realise your divinity.
Isn't it symbolic of the union between yes. Shiva and Shakti?
Yes.
That's the whole purpose of
it. Is then, but not in its origins.
Not
in its
origins.
But in Tantra, it's when the Brahmins realised that they wanted to incorporate it, otherwise part of society was going to go away. So they embraced it and said, we are going to make it pure again.
That's right, they did. They want to make it pure again.
So Shaiva Siddhanta Tantrism as practice in Shaiva Siddhanta as opposed to
non. No sex in Shaiva Siddhanta, that's right. There's
so
only
in
sex.
The deep south, they're not doing sex.
No, that's right.
That's why the north has grown and UP has grown. No, but it's definitely the north has grown. They're all realized beings, right?
And I'm just realized.
Is that the only
thing? No, but
no sex, please, get down. Oh my God.
It's only in Kashmir.
That's
why it's only in Kashmir.
Also, this whole thing about chanting.
Chanting, yeah.
This whole thing about the power of chanting.
I said that's why they both married North Indians.
Can we continue, please?
I asked about the power of chanting.
Where does the power of chanting come from?
That's in the Vedas as well.
That's not part of this. And that's a whole
thing. The tantric chanting, yes.
The chanting, yantra.
Yantra. That's right, Shri Yantra. Yes.
That's right. Can we go back to something a little more serious? You're saying that Tantricism pervades Hinduism.
Yes, medieval
from
period.
From the 5th century, through medieval what?
Yeah, back
right?
From the about 10th, 11th century, yes.
Okay,
yes.
And that it's closely linked to political power, etc., yes. etc. So could you elaborate a little bit on that? I mean, why is it that political patronage was given to
yes.
Tantric Hinduism? Well, what is it that, is it through the practice of the Siddha, to get that Siddha,
yes.
to be able to have the magical
power. Alexis Sanders is very good on this. You should read some of his work. But yes, the kings are patronizing these groups, and they're vying with each other for attention. So the Shaivas are the ones that win out because they've attracted the kings who give them money and patronage and property and so on, and they become very wealthy institutions. And part of this is because you give diksha, you give initiation to the king, and you give siddhis, power to the king, so to protect him, to protect the family, and so that he wins battles, really.
Yeah, it started with also the...
So he wants magical power. It's very attractive for a king in medieval India, this religion that gives you power, worldly power and support through these mantras. Oh, the other thing I haven't mentioned is the importance of mantra in this, particularly astra mantra, weapon mantras and so on. Om Jum Sa, the nature tantras, weapon mantra.
Where does that power come from? Is it the vibration? It comes from
well,
the
that's
discipline
what
they
say, yeah.
Doing
yeah. So to wind up, let's...
Let's...
Before you can ask questions, I want to finish by saying that...
Let the professor finish. I'm not giving you a chance.
There's... on the last page of this sheet, on page 3 actually, not the last page, are tantric, these questions that you need to ask, are tantric traditions relevant today? I mean, yeah, they do sex in Kashmir and also in California, but not in South India, not in Tamil Nadu. But so, what is the relevance today of this? I mean, can we learn anything from these old traditions? And I arguably we can. They teach us about interrelationship, about the person-community-cosmos relation, which they're very, very keen on. which we've lost sight of perhaps in modernity. Are tantric traditions world-affirming or world-denying? That's a very interesting question. On the one hand, they seem to be very world-affirming, because they're affirming the experience of the senses and so on. And yet, on the other hand, they're saying, yeah, we can go beyond the world egg, we can get out of it. There's a better universe next door, let's go, really. There's that view as well. So you've got these both world-affirming and world-negating dimensions in tantrism. And that's very interesting to explore and look at. Okay, and what do they teach us about gender difference? That the tantric traditions are, on the whole, very affirmative of equality between male and female, Shiva and Shakti. But did that play out in the political and domestic realms? To some extent, but not. I mean, there were certainly gurus, female gurus, in the Kashmiri tradition. So we end with questions. And why is the cosmic hierarchy so complicated? That's a very interesting question. Do the tantric traditions develop from Vedic Brahmanical tradition, or where are they coming from? Are they coming? I mean, I've talked about these coming from these low caste groups, but where are they getting it from? Is it coming from ancient shamanic type experiences, or what? And what is the relationship between the Buddhist Shaiva and Pancharatra Tantra? Another interesting historical question. And what's the meaning or function of the erotic or impure worship? We've had that question earlier today. And do tantric traditions lead to the breakdown of social values? That's what R.C. Zainer argued, that tantric traditions are inherently immoral. And indeed, Bhatta gets put in prison for making this claim, since it accuses the kings of Kashmir, you're adopting these tantric practices, that's going to lead to moral breakdown and the erosion of social values in the Kashmir Valley. And the king says, no, it's not. So we're left with these questions. So we've got 10 minutes for questions.
But the fact that you're asking, do they derive from the Brahmanical tradition or not, means that you don't believe the story that they were a direct revelation.
Oh, I don't know.
From the divine. Because that's where it's derived from, revelations.
That's what the tradition says. It's the direct revelation from the divine, yes. So, but as an external scholar, we have to... there's a certain hermeneutics of suspicion, really, that you have to look at it in terms of where did the history...
Are they really derivative?
Yes, that's right. And you can see that the Vedic tradition has very similar kind of ideas of divinization of the body and so on. So you can see it coming out of there. But
the relationship between person, community, and cosmos.
And what happens when you get out of the egg? Where do you go?
What, you become Shiva.
Absolute consciousness.
Yeah, where do you go? Absolute consciousness. Absolute consciousness.
So then do you actually then disappear as an individual?
You don't. I get
Oscar in the egg and Shiva Loka.
Yes.
The soul becomes like God. There's still a distinction.
That's right.
You don't totally merge. When you get out of the egg, then does that individual soul completely
according to the Siddhanta tradition, yes.
Sorry?
Yes. According to the Kashmir Shaivas, you get out of the egg, your soul disappears. You become one with Shiva. That's right.
Shiva
Loka. You go beyond the Shiva Loka. Once you're outside the Shiva Loka.
But what about other traditions besides the Shaivas?
The Shaiva Siddhanta.
Other traditions other than the Shaivas. You get out of the egg, what happens?
Oh, the Vishnu tradition.
One sinner. One time.
So, I just answered this question. Outside the Kashmiri Shaivas say you get out, you become one with Shiva. There's a no distinction. The Vaishnavas never maintained that. They said that they never had this model of getting outside the egg. You go to Vaikuntha where Shiva is, where Vishnu is. But you never merge with Vishnu.
So you keep your personal identity.
You keep your personal identity.
You come back to parties.
Even when you got rid of all the karma, you continue forever and ever.
Yes, that's right.
An individual soul.
That's
so then there are like hundreds of souls up there.
That's right.
It's like the Jain philosophy where there's all the souls.
That's right. It's very, very, very close to the Jain philosophy. Very, very close.
It is.
Yeah.
But does that mean in Vaishnavism you do not have this concept of Atman and merging the Brahman and all that? You don't merge.
On the whole, not. But you do. I mean, it's not a blanket. You do get some Vaishnavas who like the Jayaka Sanghita, that's very non-dualistic in some ways, but it always maintains there's some residue of duality between the self and God. So generally Vaishnavism's traditions tend to be more dualistic. Than the Shaiva ones, but not entirely so. In fact, non-dualism is a pretty... it's a minority philosophy in the majority of Indian history, to be honest.
the Vaishnavites in some ways quite similar to Christianity in that sense.
Yes.
And some of the prophetic religions.
Yes.
Well, there is no rebirth in Christianity.
That individual entity does continue.
That's right.
Even if there's no further karma in
that
life.
That's right. That continues because it's a vishesha. It's a particularity that carries on.
Individuality.
And the Shaiva Siddhanta call it anu, atom. That's the soul is an atom that carries on.
A sense of individuality.
But, you know, what does that mean? Does it mean that my personality, does it mean like, you know, I like sugar in my tea and not, what does it mean? It's very difficult to... What is it that particularises one soul from another in this world once it's liberated? Does it have a personality or a name, or does it have language? These are very interesting questions. Or is it just a blob sort of like up in heaven somewhere?
The interesting thing also is why from Kashmir, because Kashmir at that time was largely Buddhist.
Yes. This came after the Buddhists, although Abhinavagupta has a very lively dialogue with the Buddhists. So he wrote his last mature work before, at the end of his life, was a commentary on a text from the Ishvara Pratyabhijna, the recognition of the Lord, which was an earlier text, and his great-grandfather wrote this text. And that's a polemic against the Buddhists' view of the self.
But there is Tantric Buddhism.
Yes, Tantric Buddhism.
So then was it like an offshoot of the Tantric Buddhism?
Tantric Buddhism is an offshoot of this.
Oh, Tantric Buddhism
is an offshoot.
This is that way around, yeah.
But what is about these yantras that, you know, they give you to worship, or this is part of the Tantric religion?
That's right, these yantras, they developed, particularly the Sri Vidya in the south, they developed. A later tradition came, it's called Sri Vidya, which had this yantras, these interpenetrating nine diagrams, which became the standard ritual pattern that you worship them and then you visualize it in yourself. That's right.
There's a bit of discussion going on here because Richard Gombrich, of course, said that the whole world has emanated from Buddhism. but he did say that Tantra, everyone seems to have the impression that Tantra emanated from Buddhism. But you've made a very definitive
statement. Yeah, it's definitely the other way around. We know we can prove this. You've got Buddhist texts which are exact copies of Shaiva texts which we know are older. And the Buddhist texts, they cross out Bhairava and they put Heruka or something like that, you know. They just crib them. They actually copy the text as these, you know, these poor mind describes.
You change it over depending on whether you're a Hindu or a Muslim.
That's right.
But
it's not that it comes from some amorphous non, you know. It comes from Shaivism. This is the point.
So you could see, I suppose, the Buddhist stupas have become centres for idolatry.
Yes.
So you could also see a logical progression to the take that to an extreme, and there's Tantrism comes in.
Yes.
The Buddhist monasteries in Kashmir.
I mean, you can develop... I mean, the Buddhists were very clever because they fused the earlier philosophy onto it.
Even he said Patanjali Yoga is from...
So the Buddhists fused Tantric Buddhism with earlier Mahayana Buddhism in a very clever way. So Buddhism was ripe for Tantrism to come into it. But it's historically, its origins are in the Shaiva traditions.
Can you just do an overall timeline? Because we just have this discussion. I'm now confused about whether Vedas have anything to do with Hinduism or Vedas. No, I'm sorry. This isn't like, you know, some people just hear themselves. We listen to the story of the Ramayana for 3 days and say, well, who was Rama?
Who was Rama? Yes.
No, but honestly, this is a Hinduism, Buddhism, and other things. So there's one school of thought, simple-minded, you know, where I came in, which is, you know, there were these Vedas, and then there were all these, what I thought some sort of revealed wisdom, and whether it's true or not. And then from there came sort of a Hindu thought, which is the new way I now think about Hinduism. And then other things also generated from it, and then they all absorbed and merged and over the years. But then the question is, we were just having this discussion. So basically, do the Vedas have anything to do with Hinduism in the sense of...
It's a very good question. Yeah.
I don't know.
That's the root of Christianity.
Yeah, I mean, I think the case for
Has anyone read that? I mean, who's read the Vedas? Who reads the Vedas? Nobody.
There's too much chaos. You can't follow anything. No, I think there are too many professors now.
One professor, please.
One singer, one song. Actually, this whole thing has been a setup by Christians to. At the end of the course, you don't even know if Hinduism is connected with the Vedas.
This is the first time again.
Okay. Listen, guys, let's try one at a time, please. Let's try one at a time.
The Veda is at the root of Hinduism. The Vedic tradition is Hinduism now. The Veda is at its root, at its heart. And the Brahmanical tradition is the central core, in my view, of what we call the Hindu tradition. The word Hindu only comes in the 19th century. It's only the 15th century, the word Hindu. But before then, you could see, I mean, the fact we don't have the word for architecture in the Middle Ages doesn't mean to say there was no architecture. It seemed like Hinduism is a bit like that. Along the way, you've got these other traditions coming into this mainstream tradition. Now, this tradition has great power to appropriate everything as it rolls along. So it appropriates the Tantric tradition, Bhakti, Krishna, all the gods, who are probably local kind of deities who get absorbed by the Brahmanical tradition. And it's great skill in doing that, and that's one of it's lasted for thousands of years because of that. And the Tantric tradition, I'm not very good at Vedic dates, but the scholars think about 1500 BC. Now, this is controversial, I know, but say...
So where is 15th century on that line?
Well, let's have 15th century here.
There, okay.
15th century. Now, 11th century here. So, 5th century, sorry, it's not to scale. 5th century, Tantric, the Nishvasa Tantra is the earliest Tantra that we know of, which has just been edited now.
And Buddhism comes before that.
Hmm?
That's before that.
What is before that? Buddhism. Is 400. The Buddha dies 400 BC. Tantric Buddhism doesn't develop till about the 5th, 6th century.
Okay.
So this text and these texts like it directly influenced Tantric Buddhism, and we can show that. We can show that the Tantric Buddhism only arose subsequently to Shaiva texts.
But that does not mean that the Buddhism did not influence
Hinduism. Oh, no, it doesn't mean that. No.
Where did it start, was my question.
So Buddhism, I mean, particularly back here, Buddhism strongly influences Hinduism.
What are those two arrows?
The other influences.
Which one?
Bhakti.
Tantra,
Krishna, whatever.
Yeah, different local gods become Hindu gods. This process of Sanskritization and identification. Krishna is a good example. He starts as a local tribal god who becomes identified with Vishnu and Vasudeva and Narayana.
Krishna was much earlier, wasn't it?
Yeah, much earlier.
It was all called Vedic philosophy till the 15th century. That's when the word Hindu comes in anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was all called Veda. So Veda is foundation. Hindu before that.
That's it. So basically,
the Vedanta.
Yes, Brahmanical.
Yeah, Vedic.
That's right. But Buddhism does influence. I don't know if Professor Gombrich spoke about the Shramanas. Did he talk about the Shramanas? The Shramanas? Well, there were Jains, Buddhists, other groups called Ajivikas, Lokayatas, who were not Brahmins. They were against the Brahmins, and they were the Buddhists, and they do strongly influence the ascetic traditions of Brahmanism. Yoga. You read Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, Vitarka, Vichara, Ananda. All these are Buddhists. They're just cribbed from Buddhist meditation. So there's borrowings both ways.
But you could say it's like the Reformation affected Christianity.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was a regeneration of the Hinduism, the way it was being practiced, whatever Hinduism is.
Yes.
A reaction against the Brahmanical caste.
That's right.
And of course, it then gets absorbed back again.
That's right. Exactly what happens. That's a pattern throughout
really
whole history.
That really came with the Shankaracharya. Yeah. The Reformation of Hinduism really started with Shankaracharya.
Well, there was another Reformation with Shankara.
I mean, Buddhism and all were not part of Hinduism.
Because he's reacting against Buddhism, of course. So
he's incorporating as well.
Yeah, he's incorporating it into it as well.
And if you believe that the Aryans came and migrated to India, did not originate in India, then then actually the Vedas came from outside?
Well, they could have originated in India, but from groups whose origins were outside. Yes. Yes.
Because a lot of the gods of the Vedas are supposed to be in common with
Zoroastrian, the Mitanni culture, which is a Hittite culture, are the same gods. Mitanni, the Ashvin twins, Mitra, all these gods.
And when Mohenjo-daro and all took place, was there already Vedic thing there?
No.
That was before the Vedas.
It's like a pressure cooker. This is my map of India. You've got two rivers here, Indus and the Ganges. All the influences come into India, it seems, from the outside. And they all get boiled up like a pressure cooker, you know, and all the tensions are arising. Now, you can draw a line there, two spheres of influence. The Indo-Aryan language is in the north, Dravidian language is in the south. Sanskrit is an Indo-Aryan language. Now, if there was no Aryan migrations, you have to account that either there was a spread of people across North India that spoke Sanskrit, or you have to account for the spread of the language without people. Now, you can have spread of language without people, as we get in Wales, with English. But it seems to me more likely that you've got a spread of language with people. You've got to have good reasons for a local population to adopt a different language. It did happen, but the easier explanation is that you have a spread of people speaking language. And the Dravidian languages are the languages in the south. You do get up here, Brahui in Pakistan, a Dravidian language called Brahui, still there. And that's very interesting.
What is the Dravidian language linked to? Is it linked to any other language?
No. The people don't know. It's very difficult.
The indigenous language of India. Indigenous
language.
Is there an alternative theory?
The Indus Valley. Some people say the Indus Valley culture about 2000 BC produced the Vedas. That's one view.
So
some people argue that the Indus Valley culture produced the Vedas, and that the Indus Valley culture spoke Sanskrit. The other view is that the Indus Valley culture spoke a Dravidian language, and that the Aryans came in or migrated in from them, and they were the ones who composed the Veda. They have composed it in India, but the people's origins were outside of India. That's the other view.
Because this whole Indo-Gangetic culture and civilization, starting from Mohenjo-daro time.
Yeah.
So what was this? We always read that there was this Indo-Gangetic culture, which actually evolved into the Vedas, the way we know the Vedas, because the Vedas were handed down.
Yes, that's right.
And so in those days, even before we know of the existence of the Vedas, there was some culture there which actually evolved into the Vedas.
Yes,
because it was the Indo-Gangetic culture.
That's right. The trouble is archaeological continuity from the Neolithic times right the way through to the medieval times. Yes, it is. Yeah. I don't know how come that Dravidian language is. Well, Mount Malayalam is full of Sanskrit, but that's because it's developed since then.
We expected you to solve all the problems of the world in 3 days.
3 days? 5 minutes? Everyone's just talking back and forth. It has to happen before the end of today.
We've got to stop anything, haven't we?
We're stopping now?
Yeah.
Professor Gavin Flood?
Thank you.